session on 126642.
Major Weller, Realtor.
We had had an attempted air supply, but from a light aircraft, or two light aircraft, who came over. They were Oster spotter planes, if I can remember rightly, and we were urging the pilots to drop boxes of ammunition, which were also not large boxes, but I think they were rather afraid that if they dropped them, they would land on us and cause somebody an injury, and therefore eventually they had to, they flew off. They may have been concerned about that, and possibly dropping them in the, into the, amongst the Chinese. That any large supply drop at that stage, I think, was probably out, because the feature itself was surrounded by valleys and other hills. It's very, very difficult to concentrate a drop on accurately, because, you know, you do a supply drop, it spreads over quite a big area. And I think the last thing that Brigade wanted was to see us supplying the Chinese with more weapons, more ammunition, and more food. And so we realized then that we weren't going to get resupplied at all.
Were you aware at that time of any attempts to break through to relieve you?
We knew that, I think it was a Filipino battalion, with the help of some tanks, were going to try and get through, but the road leading up to us in places was very, very narrow, with steep hills on one side and sheer drops on the other. And one or two tanks were knocked out 2 or 3 miles back, and that blocked the road, so there was virtually no question of any armor getting through along that track. And the Chinese, as I said, by that time had infiltrated and had completely encircled us, and they were then 5 or 6 miles back. And the our supply echelon it's about 9 miles back originally, was also become was also coming under attack, and so any question of resupply was out.
For you personally, how did this fighting compare with that which you had experienced against the Japanese in Burma?
Well, it was different in as much that we were fighting in more open country in Korea, whereas, suppose, in Burma, you were fighting in jungle conditions, and quite often your fields of fire, your view of the area was considerably reduced.
How did the Chinese enemy compare with the Japanese?
I would say the Japanese probably were more fanatical, although the Chinese fought well. I mean, they once you committed large numbers like that, it's very difficult to find out how they, as an individual, how good they were. I mean, mass numbers, one would follow the other. They were all they would all operate in groups, whereas the Japanese, we found, were, as individuals, were very tough and would go on fighting right up to the very last. And I think the units who were involved in the early part of the war in Burma were up against some really first-class Japanese soldiers. It's difficult to know how to compare one with the other. The circumstances were so different.
Did you hit either the Chinese or Japanese enemies personally?
No, not me personally, no. I saw them being hit, and because at that stage, during the battle, the Imjin battle, I had a machine gun quite close to my own position, and I know that the NCO in charge of that certainly killed 2 or 3 soldiers, which we saw about 150, 200 yards away from us, and so I saw that. But
who was the NCO, do you remember?
Yes, sadly, he's now passed on. He was one Sergeant Hopper, who eventually went to the Dorset Police and became a superintendent. He was a very good chap. He was a Dorset.
But he died after Korea?
No. He died after coming back to civilian life. I think at this stage it might be worth noting that when we were at Colchester, we had to be brought up to a war establishment. And we had very little equipment, because we'd been in Jamaica at that time, in sort of what I call a peacetime setting. And suddenly, to have to get ready to go to war, we had to get a lot more equipment, weapons, armor, armoured vehicles, carriers, mortars, anti-tank guns, and of course men as well. And so a lot of reservists were called up to bring us back up to strength. That is why you had somebody like Sergeant Hoper, who was a Dorset, and we had a number of others. I did in my own company. I had them from all over the place. Quite a number from London who had been in units in that part of the world during the 39-45 war, who were recalled to bring us up to strength. So we weren't entirely an all Gloucester battalion. Not all Gloucesters coming from Gloucestershire. We had a lot of reservists who were absolutely first class, because they had experience from the 39-45 war, and they were able to give a lead and encouragement to the younger members of the battalion, particularly the sort of 18-year-olds who were known as K2, K-type volunteers, who, you know, volunteered to come in just to go out and take part in a battle.
Why K-type?
That's what they were called. They were called K-type volunteers. They were young 18-year-olds, most of them.
How tiring and wearing was it for you personally in the battle? Did you get any sleep?
No. You couldn't sleep. There was so much noise going on, and you were on the move, and you were concerned with whether or not positions had to be adjusted. So very few people slept. I mean, it wasn't just a question of the commanders and section commanders being awake. I mean, everybody was awake. You could probably snatch a couple of hours sleep if you dozed during the day. You may have been lucky enough to have dozed a bit during the night, but you were pretty uncomfortable, and we were getting hungry by this stage too, so you didn't really sleep. Not with in a battle like that, you don't.
Were you praying for the opportunity to sleep, or did it not?
I don't think it occurred to you. I mean, you were tired, and you keep calling on your reserves when you're tired, and it gives you a little fillip to keep going. You just dare not relax. I think that the adrenaline is flowing fairly fast at that stage, and so you just keep on.
Were you getting anything to eat and drink?
Very little to drink. I mean, what we had on that final feature, of course, we had to carry up the hill with us. I know that our regimental sergeant major was sent down to the valley where the battalion headquarters had been, by which time one or two trucks had been set on fire, to get what rations he could. He took a small party down and brought up two or three boxes of compo, with these 10-man ration packs. And in the dark, he distributed out of these packs round to as many of the groups that he possibly could whatever the box contained. So it was not uncommon for one little group to get a tin of cheese and a packet of latrine paper, and somebody else to get powdered potato, but for no means of opening the cans. At least they probably eventually got them open. But that was the sort of supply that we had on those last 2 days. But I think it's only right to mention that up to that point, the battalion had been very well fed. We had our own rations. We managed to do a lot of bartering with the Americans, so we had American rations as well. And we had Australian rations, and by way of sort of fresh food, which was dropped to us, not during the battle, it was before that. I mean, we were getting some good supplies, and so we were all pretty fit. And I think that was just as well, because it stood us in very good stead, not only during the battle, but subsequently, when, of course, we were captured and were moved north.
Are there any specific incidents that you can recount that you witnessed personally during the battle?
No, I can't think of any specific incidents. One saw a certain amount of movement, who saw things going on, soldiers moving their position. But everybody's is involved so much in doing their own thing that you don't notice any particular thing at all. I mean, you just take it as you know, the normal activity.
We were saying earlier about the instance of somebody like a 19-year-old National Service subaltern in charge of a platoon, which to a civilian in 1992 seems an extraordinary amount of responsibility that you give to somebody so young. How do you personally feel about that?
Well, I think we are all trained, irrespective of whether you're a platoon commander, whether you're a young officer, or whether you're an NCO, we're all of us trained to take responsibility at an early age. That is why we're selected, and that is why we're privileged to be, as officers, to be given the commission, because we have shown during our training we've got the leadership qualities and are able to command 20 or 30 men or more under all kinds of conditions. And we're bound together by a strict code of discipline, comradeship, call it what you will, but we are bound in a unit much closer, I suspect, than any group, comparable group in civilian life, because of the very nature of the job that we've got to do.
Can you tell me now about your own personal experience during the breakout or attempted breakout?
Well, when a commanding officer managed to have a small group, orders group, on the top of Gloucester Hill gave us an order in which we would try and break out, and then we did. And when we would try, at that stage we couldn't have gone on fighting any longer. We had no ammunition left, or very, very little. No food, and the position had obviously became untenable, and so we broke out in small groups. I went over the hillside from the position that I was in with four or five chaps, and I knew that other remnants of my company had also already broken out, because the hill was quite a long one, and they'd all taken off in various directions. And a small group that I was with got down into the valley, and we started going south. But we came upon the ridge, and we were fired at again. We had one or two casualties. And I found myself with the adjutant, Tony Farrar-Hockley. At one stage, he'd also come off the hill. And we went on as far as we possibly could. And this is when I think we realized just how tired we were, because, you know, our legs wouldn't go fast enough. The Chinese were shooting at us. We'd had one or two casualties, so eventually we had to give up. We couldn't go on any further. But we were pretty exhausted.
Can you describe how you were captured?
Well, I mean, I was captured with a group. There were several Chinese who came down from the hills, and some who came up from the valley behind us, and all they had their rifles pointing to us, and that was it. And they rounded us up, small, and marched us back down towards the Imjin.
Can you describe their demeanor?
They didn't seem to be over aggressive in any way. I think they realized that they may have captured us probably quicker than they anticipated. But we weren't roughly handled. We were invited to get a move on and get back quickly, and they escorted us back. But there was no brutality being shown by them.
So there was no booting people up the backside to make them move faster?
Oh, no, not at that point, no. I think they were tired themselves, too.
When you saw them close up, what did they look like?
Like just like Chinese. I mean, they didn't, as one expected to see them, and we'd seen pictures of them, of course, and that's what they looked like. They looked a bit scruffy, mud-stained, their clothing did, because they obviously had a pretty rough 10 days or fortnight or so leading up to the battle and taking part in the battle.
What did they do with you then?
Well, they eventually gathered us the other side, north side of Gloucester Hill, between there and the Imjin, and gradually, as the small groups were rounded up, we were all concentrated in one area. When I say all, obviously there were other groups within from the battalion who were in different parts, but the group that I was in must have been about 50 or 60 or so. And there we waited for quite a time before they moved us over the Imjin River, which happened that night, the night of the 25th. So from about midday, 12 o'clock, until that night, and we were just there in a group sitting down on the ground with the Chinese guards around us.
Did anything about the Chinese army surprise you once you had the opportunity of seeing what it was like amongst them?
No, because you see, you only saw odd. No, the you couldn't really judge how the army was organized. I mean, they were groups of Chinese. They were obviously very spread out. They probably operated in small sections, a lot of them, of course. And one felt that once they'd got us all together, after we'd been captured, that we were then being handled by an element of their forward troops who were then responsible for us as prisoners of war, and the fighting soldiers of the Chinese were probably then going on, you know, beyond Gloucester Hill towards Seoul, so that you had a what I call a follow-up group of those who were responsible for gathering in any prisoners, as we would do in our own army.
Did there appear to be people giving orders, or was it organized on some kind of...
Oh, I think so. Yes, it appeared as there were one or two Chinese in charge. Of course, they very closely integrated with their political wing as well, and so I suspect at the time that there were political elements there, because obviously they wanted to try and get information.
But at this stage, you hadn't been interrogated.
No, no, no.
I interrupted your narrative with you recrossing the engine, I think.
Mm.
You can take it from there.
Yes, we stayed as a group until later that day. In fact, it was dark when they moved us across the Imjin, and then to start the move north to the Yellow River.
Can you describe what happened to you on that trek north?
Well, we moved by night, and they occupied small villages. They turned out North Koreans, and they put us into some of these Korean huts during the daytime, and they were worried, of course, about air attacks from the Americans, and so we didn't move in columns during the day. We moved at night.
Were you being attacked from the air?
Airplanes came over. We weren't actually attacked at all, not the column that we were with. I think very few columns were attacked. Whether or not the Allies knew the routes that the prisoners were being taken along, I don't know. They probably had some idea, and whether or not they were getting any information back, whether they had agents in North Korea getting information back about the movement of prisoners, one will never know. But we weren't actually attacked. But the Chinese had a fairly good system. As soon as they could hear airplanes, they had bugles and whistles which went off away from one hill to the other, and everybody then was made to go and lie down or get off the track. So from that point of view, simple but precautions were taken by the Chinese to make sure we weren't attacked.
How many were in your party approximately?
I think about 60 or 70 to start off with.
Who was the senior officer?
Oh, I can't remember now. There was a time when they started to interrogate on the second day, and I was then taken away and put in a hole in the ground because they wanted information which I wasn't prepared to give. And so I was eventually I got segregated from the rest of the group that I was with, and one other officer as well. And so we stayed isolated for some time before we joined up again in the prison camp.
Can you describe in detail how the interrogation was conducted, please?
On the way up, I mean, it didn't last very long. I mean, you were asked certain questions, and if you cooperated, I suppose you would have been released. If you didn't cooperate, well, you would be kept under guard. At that stage, I mean, we were, I suppose the majority of us were pretty bloody-minded, and we weren't prepared to sort of give information.
But how many people interrogated you?
One.
Did he speak good English?
No, not good English, but he spoke English.
Can you remember what he wanted to know?
Well, he wanted to know, obviously, how many men there were in the unit, where we'd come from, who sent us there, who our commanders were, what equipment we had, all the usual sort of questions that, you know, an interrogator would ask.
So what did you say?
Nothing. Except your number, rank and name.
But
of course, one realised, of course, they must have known, they knew that we were probably Gloucesters by this stage. They probably had a lot of information about the British Brigade, too, and which they used later on in the interrogations when we got to the prison camp.
So how did this man respond when you just repeated name, rank and number?
Oh, he said, you must understand that you've now been liberated, and you must learn to educate yourself and understand the peace-loving people, as they call themselves, are going to be lenient towards you if you cooperate and learn by your mistakes. I mean, all this sort of nonsense, you know, the typical communist jargon.
Did he threaten you?
Pardon?
Did he threaten
you? Oh, well, yes, you were always threatened that you wouldn't get any food and you wouldn't go back, you wouldn't be returned, and all this sort of thing, but one got used to it.
Did he appear to be some kind of officer?
I think he was, he was a political officer, I'm pretty sure about that. In fact, most of them were. You see, the further we went back, you were leaving behind the fighting elements of the Chinese army. I mean, you were then being taken over by guards who had probably been sent down behind the fighting element of the Chinese for the specific purpose of keeping of looking after prisoners, any prisoners they may take. And as you went further north to our final prison camps, you passed then into what would be the equivalent, I suppose, of the KGB.
So how were you punished for failing to satisfy him?
Well, I was kept in isolation for 2 or 3 weeks with another officer who was much the same, had much the same view that I did. And we weren't the only ones. This was happening amongst whole groups of prisoners who were being taken off. The Chinese were probably very anxious at this stage to get as much information as they possibly could. And so they were interrogating everybody. And by cross-examination and cross-interrogation, they could find out, say, from one chap who his immediate section commander was, without in any way questioning the loyalty or the integrity or the outlook of the majority of our soldiers. If you said to a chap, "Now, we know all about your section commander. He's a good chap, isn't he?" "Oh, you mean Lance Corporal Smith?" "Yes, he's a splendid chap." So, I mean, this is all part of the clever way in which interrogation will take place. I don't know whether Dennis Watmore harped on this one at all.
Well, he wasn't captured.
Pardon?
He wasn't captured.
He wasn't captured, no, but I mean, he might have had experience later on in his career, this sort of thing. So it's not difficult to break down people unknown to them that they are being broken down. However,
who was the officer with you?
Captain Bill Morris, who's sadly died 2 or 3 years ago, and is a widow's great friend of my wife and myself, and lives in Cheltenham. So he and I spent a time together, and eventually, of course, we were moved as the two of us, mixed up with Chinese, some North Koreans, who were civilians going about their normal occasion. We gradually eventually finished up north of North Korea, the Yalu River, in a prison camp.
Did they deprive you of food as a punishment?
Well, no, what they did was to just give you one sort of small bowl of sorghum, that sort of purple sort of maize a day. You had that, and you had very little else. But this was happening to all the prisoners.
What did you see en route from the Imjin to the Yalu in terms of the people and...
Well, you saw very little because the Chinese obviously kept the civilians away. And the North Koreans didn't appear, the civilians didn't appear to be particularly interested. I wouldn't say they were all that happy with what had happened to their own country. Pyongyang, the capital, had been pretty badly knocked about. the Chinese had taken over lots of villages to billet their own troops in and used houses for their own their own purposes. And so I don't think the civilians were kindly disposed towards them at all. But we didn't see a lot. We weren't allowed to mix them or talk to them or anything like that. We were kept quite separate.
Had the idea on the of escape on the trek crossed your mind, or were you just too stunned after capture to contemplate it?
What?
Escape.
Well, one thought about it. One looked for the opportunity to try and go, but then one was fairly closely guarded. See, by this time, I think they had singled out the officers in this group. They knew that I was an officer. They knew that one or two others were officers. And we were made to go up in the head of the column, marching, surrounded by quite a number of guards. Tony Farrar-Hockley managed to get across, get about, escape during the crossing of the Imjin. A very, very noble effort. He vanished under the water and sort of swam as far as, you know, as he could downstream, try and get away. Subsequently, you know, he was captured. No, the opportunity is one was always looking for, but you don't look like a Chinaman and you don't look like a North Korean. And and in that sort of terrain, in that sort of state, it would be very, very difficult.
Did you see anything of the North Korean army on this trek?
No. We saw them, but I mean, they occasionally there would obviously be liaison groups with the Chinese, but we saw very little of them. Some of our chaps were taken by the North Koreans, or were taken into North Korean areas, but I think, generally speaking, the Chinese were anxious to sort of keep us apart and not let the North Koreans get involved.
Did you get any different impression of the North Korean soldiers as compared with the Chinese?
No, it was very difficult. I think the...
Now, once you reached the Yalu, what happened to you personally?
Well, we were in, and then they segregated us. There were three or four camps. There was the officers' camp, warrant officers. There was a senior NCO's camp and the juniors' camp, corporals, lance corporals, and private soldiers. Now, the Chinese realized that if they segregated the officers from the senior NCOs and the private soldiers and the lance corporals, then they would start to break down some of the disciplines which we'd been used to, and which was part of our military training. So if they took away the officers, then a lot of the influence would then be removed, and they would more easily manipulate the more junior ranks. This, in fact, proved entirely wrong. Our training is such in the army that if every single soldier is encouraged to take on responsibility and go for promotion, so from amongst your private soldiers working up the ladder, leaders became apparent, and they took over and they gave the Chinese a pretty rough time. The same amongst the sergeants and the warrant officers. Same thing happened there, and amongst the officers as well. We still respected the rank, and we found that the Chinese were determined to break down the discipline amongst the British officers and the American officers by splitting us up into small squads. In other words, they didn't keep the British officers together, but they mixed them up with the Americans, black and white. And whether I would be right, or whether you consider that it's right that I should mention this, but I feel that the discipline amongst the British officers, the British prisoners of war, was far greater than it was amongst the Americans. Now, they'd had a rough time, I realize that, but they have a different type of discipline to what we do.